Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine is joined by Dr. David Stern. Dr. Stern is professor of pathology at Yale School of Medicine, associate director of the Shared Resources Program, and leader of the Signal Transduction Research Program at Yale Cancer Center. Here's Francine Foss.
David, you primarily are working as a cancer biologist, and so primarily you're not in the clinic, you're actually in the research setting. Can you talk to us a little bit about what interested you in cancer biology?
Well, I became interested in biological sciences in general as a kid, and as I grew older and went to college, I entered college at a time during the first fruition of molecular genetics in understanding how animal cells operate. And around the same time, the cancer problem, which had vexed clinicians and scientists for centuries, was becoming tractable through the study of viruses that cause cancer in animals. So early on in my research experiences, I became engaged in research to study how viruses that cause cancer induce cancers. And as it turns out, that early area of research in the 1970s and 1980s turned out to be directly applicable to our understanding of human cancer.
Can you talk to us about what that connection was?
Well, the connection turned out to be that many of the viruses that cause cancer in model animal systems, including mice and chickens, turn out to carry what are called oncogenes. These genes are introduced into cells they infect and take over normal cellular systems and, in many cases, induce them to grow abnormally in the same way cancer cells grow abnormally. Over a period of years, as these genes were identified and their functions were tracked down, it turned out that many of these same genes directly cause specific human cancers or alternatively regulate the same kinds of processes that human cancer genes regulate.
So these oncogenes are genes that were carried by viruses, or they're primarily in viruses?
Well, actually, these families of oncogenes, although they were carried by viruses, were originally picked up by those viruses and their ancestors from cells that they infected. And this is why it turned out that many of those oncogenes were very closely related to genes that cause human cancer. So, for example, a virus called Harvey sarcoma virus had picked up a gene called RAS from a mouse cell that it had infected. And then once that gene was captured by the virus and was slightly altered by mutation, the virus became capable of inducing cancers in other cells that it infected.
So these oncogenes, are these present in all humans?
Well, oncogenes are defined as genes that have sustained mutations in such a way that they promote the process of cancer. So oncogenes in humans are altered versions of normal cellular genes that, because of mutations or changes in regulation, can now promote the process of developing cancers.
So what percentage of our cancers are actually caused by these oncogenes?
Well, I would say that all human cancers are caused by genes that are sometimes called oncogenes, that is, genes that are mutated so they promote cancer. And sometimes they're subdivided into oncogenes that promote cancer by advancing a normal cellular process, such as cell division. And other genes called tumor suppressor genes normally prevent cells from dividing or having other cancer-like attributes. And so when these tumor suppressor genes are mutated, they lose their impeding function, and now cells are more likely to divide or, again, undergo some other cancer-like changes.
Can you talk a little bit about how one gets an oncogene, how an oncogene gets activated or mutated to the point where it's going to cause cancer?
Yeah, unfortunately, mutation itself is a process that's occurring chronically in all human cells as a byproduct of normal metabolic processes and mistakes that sometimes occur when cells divide. So even though exposure to external agents like radiation or environmental carcinogens can enhance the likelihood that mutations will occur, everyone is susceptible to mutations in their genome that may turn out to affect genes that, when mutated, will promote cancer.
And David, that's a question that a lot of patients ask is, how did I get this cancer? You know, was I exposed to something? And sometimes it's difficult for patients to understand that there may not have been a specific trigger.
Yes, thanks, Francine. That's a very important point. There is no way for individuals to avoid having some baseline mutation rate, which is actually a very high mutation rate. But individuals can, of course, prevent additional excessive risk by staying away from cigarettes and other activities such as radiation exposure that would accelerate mutagenesis.
Can a patient actually get screened for these oncogenes? Are there tests that that we can do to tell whether a patient has one of these oncogenes?
Well, there are two ways we think about that right now. First of all, there are some families that are cancer-prone. And so, for example, as you know, in breast cancer, maybe 5% or 10% of breast cancers in this country are associated with hereditary mutations in genes called BRCA1 and BRCA2. Individuals in families that are cancer-prone may seek out genetic testing to determine if they have mutations in those genes, since candidate genes have been identified. Nowadays, also at a couple of institutions, including the Smilow Cancer Hospital, patients who have already developed cancers are being tested for mutations in a certain subset of genes that are common, possibly in their cancer subtypes. It might be breast cancer, perhaps lung cancer. And the patients will be tested for these mutations if there are medical treatments that are beneficial to the patients who are known to have the mutations.
So, David, I'm glad you brought that up because you were actually involved in some of the early work on one of the major breakthroughs with respect to developing a therapy specifically targeting a gene mutation, and that was the HER2 news story in breast cancer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thanks, Francine. I'd be happy to. After I earned my PhD, I went on to postdoctoral training in the laboratory of Robert Weinberg at MIT. And the project he assigned me was to work on a peculiar rat oncogene that was called Nu at the time, but actually turned out to be the rat relative of the human gene now called HER2. So HER2 was first discovered as a rat oncogene, and my project was to figure out what was wrong with this rat protein that enabled it to cause cancer in this rat model system. So over the years, I learned about many fundamental properties of the rat protein, including the fact that it had an enzymatic activity that we now know to be associated with a large family of hormone receptors that can sometimes cause cancer. And a few years after I began this work, Dennis Flamen, working at UCLA, discovered that this gene is commonly reduplicated in about 15 to 20% of breast cancers in this country, and that in those patients, the product of this gene, called HER2, is a major driving force in sustaining these tumors. Once Dr. Flamen had identified this change, then the question was, well, how could one interfere with this change, this overactivity of a hormone receptor that was driving these breast cancers? Also, while I was a postdoctoral work, we set up a collaboration with another laboratory led by Mark Green. And Mark Green was interested in the RATNU protein because it was a protein that we found was expressed at the surface of cancer cells. And Mark thought that perhaps by injecting rats with monoclonal antibodies that would recognize this protein sticking out from the surface of the cell, he might be able to inhibit growth of those cells as tumors. So the Green Lab developed monoclonal antibodies that recognize the retinue protein, and I was a collaborator in these studies. We helped them characterize those antibodies. And then Mark showed that, in fact, if he had tumors caused by a mutation in the new oncogene, that those tumors were inhibited by injection of a monoclonal antibody that recognized this protein. This work was the preclinical foundation for the antibody work that eventually helped Genentech develop a drug called that's called Herceptin. And Herceptin, like the original anti-new antibodies that Mark Green's lab developed, is an antibody that recognizes the portion of HER2 that projects from the cell surface, and the antibody works in much the same way as these original mouse experiments did.
So, David, that's really a fabulous bench-to-bedside story. How often do those kinds of things happen in cancer research?
Well, when I was starting out my career, and shortly after this work, I moved to Yale about 22 years ago. At the time we did this work, it was very unusual for bench scientific research to be translated into a human clinical application. In fact, the Herceptin drug targeting HER2 in breast cancer was the very first drug approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that targeted a known oncogene product. And in collaboration with having this drug work for these patients, there was the necessity of having a test which would identify the subset of breast cancer patients whose cancers are driven by overexpression of HER2. Now this test, which is done either by a technique called FISH or by another technique called immunohistochemistry, this test is routinely given to breast cancer patients entering our clinics and for women who turn out to have tumors that have excessive expression of HER2, Herceptin treatment is a very common and often effective therapy.
And oftentimes the combination of Herceptin with chemotherapy prolongs the survival of these women as well.
Yes, that's a really important point. In the early days of developing drugs targeted signal transduction molecules, and Herceptin was one of the first, the hope was that the signal transduction targeted drugs would completely replace the effective but rather difficult chemotherapies and radiation therapies that patients are still routinely treated with. In fact, as we've learned from clinical trials, most of the signaling-targeted drugs are ineffectual without being used in combination with other conventional cancer therapies. So these groups of drugs are now used in together with one another.
So, David, we started with antibodies binding to these receptors, and now we have other small molecule drugs that inhibit some of these signal transduction molecules as well.
Yes, Herceptin was one of the prototypes, but in the later part of the 20th century, investigators studying how cancer develops in humans found that the majority, if not all, of human cancers are characterized by changes in the pathways that regulate cell division. So cell division is the process by which one cell divides to become two cells. And of course, in all organisms, this process must be tightly regulated or cells will divide too often and cancers can ensue. It turns out that for mammals like ourselves, the coordination of cell division at the organismal level is achieved in part through intercellular communication. Cells send signals to one another through proteins that are hormones. And the hormones generally bind to receptors on the cell surface and trigger a cascade of processes, a signaling pathway that moves inside the cell and eventually actuates the mechanism that causes cells to divide.
David, let's talk a little bit more about that process of signal transduction when we come back after our short break for a medical minute. Stay tuned to learn more about cancer biology with Dr. David Stern.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and over 2,000 new cases will be diagnosed in Connecticut alone. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using two simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses three-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my guest today, Dr. David Stern. And we're talking about the complicated area of cancer biology. So, David, you talked a little bit about how cells receive signals from the outside through these receptors, and you call that signal transduction. Can you just define that a little bit more specifically for the audience?
Yes. In this context, what we mean is that the cells are exposed to a hormone that instructs the cells to divide or to survive or to do any one of a number of other things. The hormone will bind to a receptor, and the receptor itself activates a series of changes like a pathway inside the cell. And at the end point of this series of changes is an activation of the cell division mechanism. Now, it turns out that in human cancers, we can cause excessive cell division, for example, by excessive production of hormones that promote cell division, or by putting mutations in the receptor genes so that the receptor is overexpressed, or so that the receptor is signaling as if it had bound to the hormone that normally activates it, even in cases where the hormone isn't around. That's a very common cancer mechanism, and there are proteins that operate downstream on the pathways from these activated receptors that can also be mutated to likewise tell the cell to divide when it shouldn't.
So these pathways inside the cell are very complicated.
Well, the pathways are complicated when taken down to their smallest components, but in a general way, they're just a series of signals handed off from one protein to another protein and eventually communicating to various target proteins that either change expression of genes or again activate a process like cell division.
So basically you switch a light switch on and then eventually the light bulb goes on.
Yes, that's an excellent analogy, except instead of having wires to connect the switches, there is a relay of components involving several components in series rather than just a single wire connecting the switch to the bulb.
In the case of cancer cells, are there multiple areas where there are mutations, or generally is there just a single mutation?
Well, what we find is that there are a couple of pathways that are commonly activated in cancers, some of which promote cell division, some of which promote cell survival under circumstances where cells might be inclined otherwise to commit suicide, and that within these pathways, there are components, almost any component can be mutated to activate the pathway. So in the pathways regulated by HER2 and its relative, the epidermal growth factor receptor, both of which are often mutated in cancers, below the receptors are a gene called RAS, actually a family of three genes, and these genes are mutated in many, many human cancers. Below RAS is another protein called BRAF that's often mutated in melanoma and mutated in renal cell carcinoma and sometimes in colon cancer, and other proteins below can be activated.
Identifying these proteins has led to the development of new drugs targeting those specific proteins, and some of this work has been done at Yale.
Yes, actually, a lot of this work has been done at Yale, as well as at many leading research institutes internationally. And the good news about understanding these pathways is it's possible to develop drugs to intervene. For example, if there is a tumor that's driven by an activation of one of the receptors, including HER2 or the epidermal growth factor receptor, one can interfere with growth of these tumors in principle either by directing an antibody against the receptor that's activated or by developing a small molecule drug that inactivates what's called the warhead of the receptor, the component that signals to the next protein down in the chain. And there are many such drugs now, including Tarceva and Tykerb, which are in use in the clinics now. Or one can interfere with the BRAF protein. There's a drug developed by a company called Plexxikon that was started by the chief of pharmacology here, Yossi Schlesinger, and also director of our new Cancer Research Institute. All of these drugs, in principle, may help patients who have excessive activation of the pathways regulated by these receptors.
And again, just to let patients know, David, none of these drugs would be out there if basic cancer biologists like yourself hadn't gone in and identified these pathways that were mutated.
Yes, thanks for bringing that up. This is an important point. The chain of events that led to development of all of the new cancer therapies, including the immune modulators, the PARP inhibitors, the signaling drugs such as Iressa, Tarceva, Herceptin, BRAF inhibitors, all of these drugs were developed as the result of a chain of basic research that began 25, 30 years ago and even earlier. Much of the scientific knowledge that development of these drugs is built on has really developed over an extended period of time, and every step of the way was necessary for us to have the depth of understanding required to develop these therapies with having a good chance of them being effective and also being safe.
So, David, that segues into the next part of the discussion, which is your role at the Yale Cancer Center and the Shared Resource Center. So there have been a lot of new technologies that have been developed that have helped in terms of this effort, and one of those is genome sequencing. Can you let our audience know a little bit about what that is and how that has really been useful?
Yes. So, first of all, I should say my role in this has been minimal, except that in my capacity as director of shared resources for the Yale Cancer Center, I try and monitor and encourage core facilities at Yale that will benefit the development of cancer research and cancer therapies. One of the most important technologies that's developed recently and has been invested in heavily by the university under the auspices of Rick Lifton and the Yale Center for Genome Studies or Genome Research is high-throughput DNA sequencing. This technology is an outgrowth of DNA sequencing technologies that were developed 20 or 30 years ago. And first, for you to understand this, I should explain what DNA sequencing is. Genetic information in our chromosome is embodied in individual genes, each of which has a specific function. And the genes themselves consist of are very much like words that are spelled out with four letters called nucleotides. And it's the sequence of the nucleotides in each gene that spells out the word that is the gene and encodes the nature of the product of that gene. The product may be a protein or an RNA molecule, some kind of molecule that has a function in the cell. So when mutations develop in the genome, the DNA sequence changes. And by comparing the series of letters in the gene from tumor tissue, to the sequence of the same gene in normal tissue from the same patient, one can determine if a mutation has occurred. 10 years ago, this was mostly possible only when one was interested in a particular candidate gene, such as one of the RAS genes. But the problem was that there are at least 30,000 genes in the human genome. New high-throughput deep-read sequencing technologies actually make it possible to look for mutations gene by gene over this entire 30,000 gene complement in research samples and soon enough patient samples. And just to give you an idea of the costs at this point, in a research setting, it's possible to obtain this information for a few thousand dollars, the entire set of mutations in an entire genome. To perform a single DNA diagnostic test at the hospital nowadays also costs on the order of a few thousand dollars. So this is a revolutionary technology, both in terms of discovering what kinds of genes are mutated in human cancers, and in coming years, we expect that these technologies will be applied as part of a routine clinical diagnostic workup for cancer patients.
At this point in time, that is not part of our clinical routine.
At this point in time, the technologies and costs are getting into the range where one can easily imagine it will occur, but there are still huge practical problems, first in developing clinically approved clinical quality methods for doing this, and secondly, in handling the enormous amount of information that comes with sequencing entire patient genomes or coding sequences.
So how long does it take to obtain the sequence from one tumor?
So again, in a research setting, the analysis can be done over at the Yale facility in a period of days after sometimes a wait on the queue. But at that point, having the DNA sequence is just the beginning of a long analytical process because this is such a large collection of information. As I said, it pertains to 30,000 genes, that there's quite a bit of analysis required by experts in bioinformatics to help weed out the most interesting changes.
It sounds like the needle in the haystack story.
In some tumors, it is a needle in the haystack. One of the issues has been the enormous variability in the human genome among individuals. And as more individual human genomes are sequenced, we're learning more about which changes are common in the human population and probably not connected with the cancers, and which are unusual. The other advantage in working with cancer patients is that most of the mutations that cause the tumors actually develop in the patient in the lifetime of the individual. And that means that any unusual sequence that is also found in normal DNA from that same patient is unlikely to be interesting.
So that gets into another question, and I think you alluded to this at the beginning, and that is the whole issue of DNA repair. That you've got all these genes out there that may become mutated, and then you've got a process to repair them. So what goes wrong in cancer?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of this session, DNA mutation is a corollary of life, and all living organisms are constantly subjected to mutations in their DNA. In fact, the same DNA repair processes that are present in mammals, many of them are also present in bacteria. So as a result of the constant need of organisms to repair DNA, they have developed a number of DNA repair systems that seek out changes in the DNA and fix them before they're passed on to daughter cells. There are certain human hereditary cancers that are caused by alterations that inactivate one of or more of these DNA repair systems. These include a disease called xeroderma pigmentosum, which is a result of a mutation that prevents cells from repairing sunlight-induced DNA damage. And as a consequence, these individuals are at very high risk for development of multiple skin cancers. And I also mentioned earlier that there are two hereditary mutations, one in BRCA1 and one in BRCA2, each of which can cause a large minority of especially familial breast cancers. It turns out that mutations in these two genes interfere with another form of DNA repair called recombinational repair.
Dr. David Stern is professor of pathology at Yale School of Medicine, associate director of the Shared Resources Program, and leader of the Signal Transduction Research Program at Yale Cancer Center. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.